Hello and welcome to another episode of Mathophile, where this time we had the pleasure of talking to Mr. Subhash Ghimre, who is the current editor-in-chief of the daily newspaper Republika Nepal. In our conversation, we cover the crucial role of the media in moderating democratic institutions, especially in developing countries. We talk about why a private and independent media is important, especially when other checks and balances on democracy rely on the government and the legislature for their daily wage. We also talk about development and why developmental aid provided by external sources is often ineffective in providing aid to those who need it most. All this and more in our conversation. Hello and welcome to this episode of Mathophile. Well, we have the pleasure of being joined by Mr. Subhash Ghimre, who has recently graduated with an MPP from Harvard and is currently the editor-in-chief of Republika Nepal, which is the leading daily newspaper in Nepal, and it's doing incredibly well in covering a lot of what is going on in Nepal today. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with the student protest that started a couple of months ago in response to Mr. Oli's response to COVID-19. Because a lot of these students are describing the response as being inadequate. Can you just briefly tell us what the Oli government's response to COVID-19 has been and why there is so much political unrest among the student bodies particularly?
Well, to start with, like a lot of populist leaders around the world, Prime Minister Oli basically dismissed the severity of the virus. So he went to the parliament and in a lot of public forum, he said, you know, this is just like a common flu. It will just go away. The Nepalese have a very strong immune system and, you know, we'll handle this. But obviously now you've seen that the cases have been increasing like anything. And so if the hospitals are overwhelmed and the tests have not increased, the people have to wait for days to receive their PCR results. So all this came in the backdrop of the government dismissing this virus early on. They basically failed to manage the people coming in from India. The Nepalese workers were in India and also a large number of them in the Middle East. So when they started coming in, the government was not prepared to handle them. So there was no sufficient quarantine centers to hold them to test, and to put them for a few days. Instead, they put them in buses and they send it to their villages. So I think that sort of led to widespread transmission of the virus. And so the test did not increase and the hospital systems were not well prepared to take care of the people. So that's why the young people demanded that, the right to free health is guaranteed in the constitution, is one of the fundamental rights enshrined in the constitution. So the government better, uphold the spirit of the constitution. So that was the basic demands of the young people during that protest.
And since the protest, has the government actually responded to the protesters' demands and increased testing capacities in Nepal? Or have they still been in a deadlock of saying that, no, we don't have the capacity to expand our testing facilities?
Well, to start with, there was a lot of controversies regarding the procurement of the medical equipment. So there was a bunch of groups that were involved and the media exposed the collusion between the politicians in the government and these companies. So that sort of really, gave the message that the government is not serious about controlling this virus. And so the tests have, it depends on what do you compare with. The tests have increased. I think it's around 15,000-20,000 right now. So initially it was, 4,000-5,000. But I think given the severity of the virus and given that you have virus in every single district in the country, I think except for one or two districts, so the tests have not increased. Even today, this week, people in Kathmandu have to wait for, at least 5-6 days to receive their PCR results. So in that sense, the tests haven't really increased.
And that's awful. So is the government, has the government set its own public enterprise up to create its own test and distribute its own test, or is it liaising it out to private companies that are producing the tests within Nepal or outside Nepal and then transporting them to government facilities?
So they basically call for in the bid, the open bids. So the private companies in Nepal bid for it, and then they import the test from outside, and then they sell it to the government. So it's a long process, and there's always controversy involved in these procurement deals. You know, the people, the companies that are close to the government or the particular politician, they end up getting these huge contracts. And oftentimes, the media have widely reported this. The price of these tests and other medical equipments that was purchased by the government were way more expensive than you would normally find in the market.
Okay, and what is the political opposition's response to this? So I think the first thing to clarify is what does the political opposition in Nepal actually look like today? How strong are they in government? And surely they must have responded to this, especially if the prices of medicine and healthcare are going so high.
Yeah. So Nepal Communist Party is in the government. They have a two-thirds majority, not just in the federal parliament, but also in six of the seven provinces. So in a sense, they basically control every sphere of the government. So the opposition party, Nepali Congress, historically been a very strong party, but they are the majority. They are the opposition party in the parliament and also in the provincial parliaments. But they have not been, sort of able to protest the way that people expect an opposition party to do in a democracy. So, there's been some talks of, the leader of the opposition party colluding with the prime minister's party in some political appointment. So there's some quid pro quo happening. So that's why the party has not been very vocal about the wrongdoings of the government. So there's a little bit confusion as to why they have not sort of really gone after the government's incompetence at this point.
The opposition is, of course, one means to check the health of a democracy and the health of democratic institutions. And that seems to be failing in Nepal, given to things like corruption. What about other checks and balances on democratic institutions? What about things like the free judiciary and the freedom of press? Let's talk about the judiciary first. How robust is the free judicial system in Nepal, and how good is the judiciary at keeping a check on corruption or overpower being centered around the Communist Party in Nepal? What is the judiciary doing right now with, say, provision of healthcare? And have there been any lawsuits filed by the public about general provision public healthcare or not?
So historically, Nepal's judiciary has been quite independent and strong. Even during King Gyanendra's rule, some Supreme Court and the other courts made some daring decisions that sort of ultimately led to the fall of King Gyanendra's regime. They have, one of the branches of the government, and their role and responsibilities, clearly prescribed in the constitution. So in that sense, they are pretty independent and strong. However, so some of these appointments, the judicial appointments, they obviously they are done by the government, and so we have not seen the level of, the independence that we expect from a judiciary in a democracy, to say the least. So even in the last few months, the Supreme Court has issued orders relating to the pandemic. So just like, a few weeks ago, they said that the government should carry out a free test, a PCR test of the people, which is, the constitution guarantees of right to free health. So just 2 days ago, the government said that they are not going to be able to cover the cost for PCR tests, that people have to, do it on their own. So the media have been, blasting the government for that decision. So they are the ones who are violating the constitution and the court's order. So, the court keeps an order, but the government, a lot of time, they decide to ignore the court's order also. So that has been a little bit frustrating. So in terms of media, I think the private media is quite strong here. Just today, if you've noticed that we had a powerful editorial on the government's failure. So some of these big media houses in Nepal, they, you know, since the democracy in the early 90s, they have been quite effective, and you know, they over the years they have earned people's trust. So in that sense, they do speak for the people. They sort of carry on the sentiment of the people. But a lot of times, you know, we in the media feel like we are the only effective opposition in the country. For example, you know, the healthcare professionals working on the front line, the security people on the front lines. You know, our biggest festival started this week, the festival of, you know, Dasain, Navaratri, they call it in India. So generally the people receive 1 month of extra salary during this time of the year. So what they did was all the ministers and the lawmakers, they received the bonuses for Dasain, but the people on the front line, the security people, the health professionals, they did not receive the money. So there was a huge outcry, and the government decided that they're going to return that money and put that in the COVID emergency fund. So it is only after the outcry and wide reporting that led to this pressure. So, you know, we have not seen the kind of civil society that we used to have, you know, strong voices that could, you know, call out the government for their wrongdoings and sort of, you know, force them to make changes. So that has sort of been missing, especially after this government came to power.
And why is it that the media is so uniquely powerful in a country like Nepal, where the government is perhaps ignoring the orders of the Supreme Court, but when you have small private media outlets voicing their opinions against injustices committed by the government, what makes them so uniquely powerful in overturning governmental decisions?
Well, I think there are quite a few things. One, the private media does not depend on government for its revenue sources. So it's largely the, you know, the advertisements from, you know, private sector, so which is not controlled by the government. So they don't have to fear the repercussions from the government, one. The second, you know, the freedom of the press is inside the constitution. And thankfully, I think if you compare with other countries in South Asia, freedom of the press is quite like a universally accepted in Nepal, that if there is an attack against a journalist or a, you know, media house, it's widely condemned, and the political leaders generally don't, you know, want to make an enemy with the media here. So, and I think there's a huge trust that people place on some of these major media houses, and so that also forces the government to listen to what the media is saying. So that also, I think it sort of developed after the 90s, the restoration of democracy in the 90s, and so that sort of, you know, carried on. And obviously now you have so many other platforms, new online portals coming in, a lot of voices coming in from outside the Kathmandu also. So that all, you know, contributes to you know, force the government to listen.
Is there a public media outlet? So I know, for instance, in India, you have Doordarshan that is funded by the central government. Does Nepal also have a public media outlet? And how many people consume the public media outlet as opposed to private media outlets? Because obviously the public media is probably going to be cheaper.
Mm-hmm. So yes, we do have a public media. So we have Nepal Television. We have a daily newspaper, the state-owned daily newspaper, both in Nepal and English. But very, very few people read the dailies. But quite a few people watch the television, Nepal Television. But mostly for other stuff than the news. So majority of the people, they rely on private media houses like ours to read news and to make views and, you know, also to voice their own concerns. So it's sort of like the people don't believe what, you know, the state-owned media says. You know, of course, it's a state-owned media, so, you know, they will have nice things to say about the government. So if you listen to Nepal Television News or Gorkha Patra or Rising Nepal, you think that everything is, you know, good, well and good in the country. But on the other hand, if you read papers like ours, you know, you will be scared. I think by now people know that in order to get the real information, you have to rely on the private media outlets.
Presumably, there is a multiplicity of private news houses and private journalism houses. And again, there must be some amount of competition among these news media outlets. in dispensing the news and in increasing the consumer basis. How many firms are actually there that are reliable and trusted by the people? And what does this economic competition look like? Does it look like some people try decreasing prices, or there is just better investigative journalism with some houses that gives them the edge?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends, but comparatively small country. So you have, you know, majority of the big houses are in Kathmandu, and there are four or five big houses that have, you know, television, that have daily newspaper, both in English and Nepali, online, you know, portals and video platforms and whatnot. So they, like these three, four media houses, they sort of lead the way in a sense. And so obviously there is some competition, but I think overall, you know, these, you could trust all these media houses, and they do their own sorts of investigative journalism. And once in a while, one paper comes out with a big story, the others follow, and something. So it's almost like, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post dynamics. So something like that here that you see, you know, for example, with the Kantipur Media and the Nepal Republic, the media that I work for. So other than that, I think there is a trust issue. It's a lot of online portals in the last few years, and that have also sort of eroded the trust on media houses like ours. So they just put everyone in the one basket and say, oh, you media people, like the YouTubers, you know, they go out and interview all these scandals and run these viral videos. And so that sort of also has an impact on the way people look at the media industry and the journalist in particular. So everyone is a journalist in that sense, you know. So this YouTube guy is a journalist. I'm also a journalist. So for an average Nepali, so he would say, you know, he would not trust either of us. So I think slowly people are understanding that. I always try to give an example of, you know, when we started having cell phones, we used to get a lot of missed calls. You know, we hardly get missed calls these days. So I think it's the time will sort of heal this in a way, you know, so people will learn to consume media responsibly. And then I think it will be a while before we reach to that point.
Are there particular demographics that distrust the media more than others? So is it like older people mistrusting new media more than maybe younger people? Or do older people read more daily news than younger people? Is there a demographic divide? And what does that look like?
Well, from what we know, you know, that we keep on monitoring our back end, so a lot of these, so I think there is a different demographics have different news interest. So in our case, if you look at the younger demographic, like people in the below 25, they're more into like tech and entertainment and sports and, you know, study abroad things and, you know, environmental issues. If you look at a little bit older, you know, in arts and literature and politics. So there's a real divide. And generally speaking, you know, the young people, they tend to be, you know, they tend to keep themselves away from politics. But I think that has been changing slowly. Like you started this program with asking me about the protest. So if you look at the photos and videos of that protest, like most of these people, kids, they are very, very young people in their high school and in colleges. And they are, most of them also grew up in cities like Kathmandu. So that tells a lot about how, you know, the demographic is changing, how their interest is changing, and how they are looking at the government and the performance of the people in power. So I think overall, we tend to think that the older people are interested in politics and young people aren't. But I think that is also slowly changing here.
That's promising. And do you think that there is going to be a political party that comes up and is propped up by young people that stands for maybe ideals like anti-corruption that provides a third way out from the current Communist Party and the current opposition that seems to be in cahoots with the current Communist Party?
Well, there have been some attempts. If you look at Nepal's history, in every 10, 15 years, we have had some sort of political changes, some sort of revolutions. So the last one was in 2006. So it's been more than, you know, 10 years. And there's been a lot of dissatisfaction with the government's performance, with the role of the opposition party in the parliament. So the people are obviously looking for alternatives. And there were one or two political parties that were formed in the last few years. and they did make some impressive gains in the election last time around. So there is some hope, and people are rooting for them, in a sense that if they stand for a corruption-free Nepal, if they stand for good governance, if they stand for development, that people are waiting to see if they are real. People are waiting to see if they mean what they promise to the people. So I would say that majority of the people in Nepal are swing voters. So not a single party has won two general elections consecutively. So that says a lot about how people vote. So that people are watching very carefully, and we'll have election another general election in 2.5 years. So we'll have to wait and see. But there's some impressive people involved in these new parties, and we'll have to see. And also, I think this COVID will change a lot of things. A lot of these Nepali migrant workers working in India, working in the Middle East, they are coming back, and these are young people. Most of these people are below 40. So they have seen the world, and when they come back, they come with these experiences, and hopefully that will also inform their decisions in the coming elections also. So yeah, there's definitely space for alternative force, and there are some promising people involved, and we'll just have to wait and see.
So we've spoken a bit about private media, and then we've spoken a bit about the public media. I want to talk about a third faction of media outlets that are present in Nepal, about foreign media. What is the presence of foreign media news houses and foreign media sources in Nepal, and how many people actually consume foreign media, maybe that comes from places like the BBC or even more local television, like from India and the NDTV?
So our house prints the New York Times. So we get the New York Times every day here. We have a BBC Nepali service here that airs programs in the morning and in the evening. It's a radio service. And of course, we get all the Indian channels here. But I think people do consume a lot of Indian news. More than that, they also consume the movies and the entertainment stuff here, since almost everyone understands Hindi, they speak Hindi, so culturally very intertwined with India. But there's a huge influence of international media here. We also consume CNN and BBC television also. People especially in urban areas, well informed, they know what's happening outside of our borders, and there's a huge influence of that. Something good happens outside, then we immediately start, comparing to our situation here. I would say, we have a decent influence of international media here.
Do you think that sometimes this influence can be harmful? For instance, I think last month I saw a report from Kathmandu Post about Chinese settlements in the Humla region in the north of Nepal, which was violating Nepali-China borders and the current border agreement that is present between Nepal and China. But presumably the only place that was cited in that news report was actually an Indian news media outlet that didn't actually have factual knowledge. So in times like this, do you think that foreign news media can actively be harmful for informing Nepali people as to what's going on in their own borders?
I think there's a context to that news that you refer to. We haven't had the best of relations with India in the last few years. I don't know how much you're following on the Nepal-India border tensions, but Nepal, amended its constitution and included, Limpia Dura into its map, which India claims it's theirs and Nepal claims it's ours. So after that, there has been a series of news, especially in Indian media, some of the questionable Indian media, that the Chinese have also encroached our border along our northern border. So that news was quickly debunked by the government as the fake news, because it was supposedly issued by Ministry of Agriculture or something, and then Survey Department within the Ministry of Agriculture. I mean, that's so hard to believe. So I think that media house had to retract that news later on. Even this week, we saw some of these reportings in India. Not on some of the main major media houses that we tend to read, but some of these other houses. So that sort of sometimes I think creates trouble for us here. So we have to be mindful of what we're consuming, you know, what we're reading also. And obviously we're situated in a very, you know, interesting geopolitical, you know, landscape here with India and China not having the best of relations at this point. So I think we have to be very careful on the kind of news that we consume from both from, you know, Indian media and also from Chinese media here.
And you mentioned fake news, and fake news is, of course, a buzzword nowadays in Western media, especially given the US elections and Donald Trump's rhetoric about fake news itself. What are the checks and balances that are present in Nepal against fake news? So again, you mentioned earlier about how everyone is a journalist these days, with sources like YouTube and Facebook being widely popular and widely read. How do people check against fake news, and how do people know what news to trust in Nepal today?
You know, generally speaking, some of these trusted big media houses, they tend to do quite well. You know, they have their own verification processes, and you know, they try their best, and obviously they are not perfect. But you know, in the last few years, there have been some good fact-checking initiatives. Obviously, the private initiative that have done quite a good job of sort of pointing out the errors in some of these major media outlets that we have made mistakes, and they have pointed that out, and we have been, you know, very receptive to such initiative, and we have also, you know, made changes. So I think that has definitely alerted us and sort of reminded us our responsibility to, you know, verify this information. So other than that, I think it's the people, because, you know, you have, I think the latest count was 40,000 plus online news portals. So, you know, obviously you can't ensure that all these provide, you know, accurate information. So ultimately it's the people who decide on what to consume, how to consume. And so, you know, they will have to make their own choices, I guess. And I think our press council can do a much better job than they are doing at this point to sort of, you know, have some directives, especially for these online portals, so that, you know, they don't mislead the public. I have a feeling that these private initiatives will expand, and also the media houses themselves will sort of institute some, you know, better measures to sort of check against some of these fake news.
You, of course, refer to a very constructive process where a fact-checking agency tells you that you've printed something that is wrong, and you've been humble enough to accept that critique and then retract news or change news in the way that is factually accurate. But what about censorship, which is probably the extreme end when someone just doesn't accept that their news is fake news or their news is factually incorrect? How strong is censorship in Nepal, and who executes censorship in Nepal? How is it affected in the public's domain today?
Well, so let's see. I mean, I think, you know, Press Council is the government authority that oversees in the publications, the media here. But I think, I mean, because, you know, the freedom of the press is enshrined in the Constitution, there were some attempts to pass bills in the parliament that sort of vaguely refer to different forms of censorship that, you know, the media fraternity came out strongly against, and they, you know, sort of the government had to retract those proposed changes. Other than that, I think there is I'm just generalizing, you know, especially for these big media houses, there's very little censorship from the government, to be honest. But I think it's hard to tell when the media houses themselves are a little bit, you know, careful of what to run and what not to run. I think that is the most dangerous part, because, you know, when you don't report something big that implicates people in power or those close to power, you know, that does not serve democracy well, that does not serve people well. So I think we see some of those instances here once in a while, but that's not a wide phenomenon, especially with the big media houses.
And that sounds very promising. So I think a question to conclude this segment of the interview would just be, what is the role, therefore, if there is low censorship from the government on media houses, of the media in assuring social development in Nepal, especially when it comes to things like human rights brooches or problems with managing individual rights of people when it comes to the government, what is the role of the media then in improving improving society and quality of life in Nepal?
So I think a lot of times the media that sets light on a particular issue, you know, we've seen the government take action, be it the federal government or provincial or the local government. I mean, that's quite good. You know, a lot of times, you know, when something happens, like a police brutality, for example, and then, you know, the media houses, they do their own investigative pieces and it comes out and, you know, there's some outrage and the police or the government sort of form an investigative committee or, you know, do something about it. So that's quite good. So I think generally the government has been deceptive on social issues when we report on some of these big social issues, especially like we have, you know, the untouchability issues. Still, we see people being murdered on these cases. You know, a few months ago, one young boy was murdered in a remote part of the country because he wanted to marry a girl from a higher caste. So that sort of created a huge uproar here. There was a protest and stuff. So, you know, when, you know, media reports on these issues, it does create a difference. It does make a difference. Same thing with, you know, other issues, other social issues also. So I think they are more deceptive than you know, say you write against, you expose a big corruption, a big scandal involving ministers. They probably, unless it's really damaging, they probably don't listen to you. But some of these human rights issues and social issues that affect the people, they tend to be quite deceptive.
And just switching track slightly here, because you have both worked on local initiatives to develop Nepal, including things like a library initiative, an initiative to supply water, and an initiative to build schools for underprivileged people or people that don't have access to education. But you've also worked with the United Nations as part of the UNRISD. What is the difference of international organizations that provide humanitarian aid versus local enterprises that provide social development in helping collectively develop a country like Nepal?
So I think there's a little bit of disconnect. You know, I work in Geneva and then I work in my village in Western Nepal also. So I think that local needs that we often fail to, even in Kathmandu, you know, the policymakers, even we people working in newspapers, we, a lot of times we miss these real pictures on the ground, you know. Maybe sometimes we tend to read too much into it, or sometimes we don't sort of explore the way it should be. So I think the local needs are entirely different. You know, the kind of education that the people need, the kind of support that, you know, the farmers, for example, need, the kind of initiatives that, you know, the local people needs to change some of these, you know, bad social systems and things like that. So, you know, we can make laws here in Kathmandu, we can sound big here, but when it goes to implementing these things on the ground, I think we have to be mindful of local culture, local customs, language, in the people involved in. So I think it's a lot more complex, and we need more of a local experience to work and to affect that change at the lowest level. So I think this it needs more dedication, honesty, and, you know, the real understanding of issues on the ground. We feel that there's often a disconnect between the policymakers in Kathmandu, for example, and, you know, the real needs and the people on the ground.
And is this true even in large calamities like the 2014 earthquake that happened and destroyed large parts of Nepal and caused mass death and mass destruction of homes and livelihoods? Was relief then also directed towards urban centers like Kathmandu, or was the UNDP and the WHO coming in and helping people in rural areas as well?
So I think a lot of people rushed to help where they had access, like, for example, access to road. So people living nearby the roads, they received a lot of support initially. And the people who are, you know, off the grid, they were left with nothing. So I think it took the government and other people and other organizations a while to really figure out, oh, you know, that's where we need to focus our energy and resources on. So I think that's the tragedy of, you know, a developing country, and especially with a very difficult topography like ours. You know, it's a mountainous country and lots of hills, you know, transportation isn't very smooth here. So that also creates a lot of, you know, difficulties in delivering services, especially during, you know, emergencies. And also, like you've seen in the monsoon, in a lot of floods and landslides, and, you know, hundreds of people get killed, and a lot of time it takes, you know, days for even the security people to reach there and you know, carry out rescue operations. And so, yeah, definitely that divide that we see, and it's especially worse, you know, even the pandemics like this one, you know, the people in the cities are, you know, getting some sort of care, but think of the people in remote villages. If they get sick, you know, the hospitals are way, you know, far. You know, they, by the time they are in the district hospitals or the provincial hospitals, they, you know, sadly end up dying. So it, there is that you combine with difficult topography and bad transportation network, and it's pretty lethal for people living on the margins.
Is there a political will from policymakers in Kathmandu to improve connectivity across Nepal, so to build roads to these remote places where there are settlements? And are the people in these remote areas politically involved? Do they actively exercise their right to vote, or are they disenfranchised? Are they structurally disenfranchised and kept outside the political system?
So the local government, so the lowest tier of the government, the local government, they have been entrusted with vast power. You know, they can decide on education, health, and local infrastructures. So in the last 2 or 3 years of this new system, you know, they have dug roads everywhere, but that comes with a price. You know, it's not a proper road to start with. It's, and, you know, the engineers aren't involved. It's just the local people, you know, okay, let's dig the road from here. You know, it has to go through my house and my land and stuff. So, you know, come monsoon and, you know, just washes off everything. So that has created a lot of problem. And, you know, the roads close for 3-4 months during the monsoon. And, you know, when people get sick, there's no way out. So, yes, they do build roads, but to connect to the major highways and, you know, the local other major roads. But that has to be sustainable. That has to be well designed, in a sense that the engineers have to be involved. Oftentimes that doesn't happen. The local leaders, the local elected people, they buy the equipment and they start digging the road because they can make money off that. So it's a little bit tragic in that sense. And while, you know, there's a lot of money has been invested in infrastructure development, that has not been, you know, sort of well spent.
And do you think China is going to help improve infrastructure development, especially given Nepal's relation with the Belt and Road Initiative? Do you think the Chinese infrastructure development is going to be geared towards just major urban centers in Nepal? Or do you think the trickle-down effect of that is also going to be a better transportation network for everyone in Nepal?
You know, we don't know what will happen with BRI. You know, we have the MCC, the Millennium Challenge grant, $500 million grant from the US government, that has not been passed by the parliament. Same thing with the BRI. The Chinese government, they have been requesting for projects under BRI for almost 2+ years now, and that our government has not been able to provide them the list of the projects that we want, you know, to be included under BRI projects. So I think the China also wants to invest in big projects, you know, big hydro projects or national highways or railways and big ports that connects to major economic centers than the villages. And also, I think the government also wants these people, because our settlements are scattered. So it's very costly for us to, you know, carry out any development projects. So the government also trying to see, you know, if we can build different economic centers and different cities, big mega cities, then people will come to these cities. So we'll have, you know, easier time mapping out stuff and developing infrastructure, needed infrastructure. So we don't know what will happen with BRI. We don't know what projects the government will include under BRI projects. And I would assume that it will be more centered around urban centers and economic centers, and also, you know, that can connect big market in India, and also with you know, the transport network that connects to China.
What are the current biggest needs in Nepal as far as rural development is concerned? So what do these rural populations need most, and what do they need most urgently from either policymakers or from foreign institutions to help them develop their own economy and maybe scale up their own economies?
So I think to start with, the farmers struggle to get a good price for their goods. So there has to be a reliable road networks, you know, that is well functional, you know, around the year. I think that will make a huge difference. The electrification has been quite impressive in the last few years, but it again, there's a question of reliability. Until a few years ago, we used to have 14, 15, 16 hours of power cutoff, but that has been solved. But I think now the issue is reliability. Sometimes, you know, the power just goes off. So we need to improve on that. We need a better road network. And also I think, now we need, you know, better hospitals and schools in rural places, because a lot of these people who go to the Middle East or India to work, they send their kids and families to district headquarters or provincial centers so that they can, you know, their kids can go to a good school there. So I think there's a huge demand for a better education and a decent health system. So the basics that we often, you know, take it for granted in the Western world.
We've spoken about a lot of things so far, about the media, about some degrees of corruption, and then, of course, about development. In a nutshell, what, according to you, is the biggest problems that Nepali democracy is facing today, and how do you think we can solve that?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, even in my lifetime, I saw so many big political changes. So in any country's history, this would be unthinkable in one person's lifetime. You know, I was born under King's autocracy, which I hardly remember, you know, and then we had a democracy in the 90s. You know, I grew up in democracy. And then, you know, the king decided to take over back in 2001, which, you know, failed miserably. And then we had the Maoist war in 1996. That sort of went on for 10 years, and then the war ended in 2006. The monarchy was gone, a new system, new constitution, you know, entirely a new political setup. So we've seen a lot of things, you know. So this democracy needs to work. So if we keep on changing this system, you know, every 5-10 years, so we don't like this, let's go, that will never help us. So I think, I feel like, you know, as frustrating as it might be, I think we have to give some time for the system to settle down and to let it work. Otherwise, we never know if this was a good system or a bad system for us. It's hardly been, you know, so 2015, we came out with the constitution in 2015. We had election 2.5 years ago. Now all people are already talking about the next revolution, next, you know, next kind of political setup here. So, you know, that sounds very appealing. That sounds exciting to the people, but will that really, you know, solve our needs? Like we talked about earlier, you know, poverty, 22% of the people living in, you know, poverty, you know, things like that. So I feel like we have to be a little bit patient with the system that we have right now, and then see, you know, if it works, and eventually if it does not, then I think there's always option for, you know, us to opt for a different system.
But that sounds quite promising, and I do agree that the constitution does need some time to check whether how strong it is and how well it can be upheld, considering it's only been 5 years since the constitution was drafted and accepted. I think one last question that I have for you is, what are some good book recommendations or media recommendations, other than, of course, Republika Nepal, because I would urge everyone to read it, but what other media and books could you recommend for people to better understand democracy in Nepal, development in Nepal, or even just about the state of media in Nepal today?
Well, I would definitely recommend following some of these major media outlets in Nepal, Republika, Kathmandu Post, you know, the Himalayan Times, this Annapurna Express, this weekly Nepali Times, you know. So some of these major media outlets, they do a pretty good job of sort of, you know, giving you the picture of what's happening in the country. In terms of the books, I really have to think of the English books that that are written on Nepal and Nepali politics. There have been some books like The Strategy for Survival by Leo Rose. It's a quite good book to really understand the historical context. There's another book called The Silent Spring, again by a Westerner. There's a series of book by the book by a Nepali historian, A History of Nepal. So that sort of captures Nepal's long history and sort of its transition to different systems, and that gives a pretty good idea of country, people, and culture. And there's some novels that have been written in the recent years, like Samrat Upadhyay's few novels that are quite good to give you a better understanding of our literature, art, and culture and history. So yeah, if you're interested in Nepal, and you can find these resources quite easily.
Excellent. And I would recommend reading up the Republika Nepal editorial that came out earlier today on why the government in Nepal has failed, because it is an excellent editorial and gives you an excellent context as to why people are actually agitated against Oli's government today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Subhash. This has been incredibly useful and incredibly informative.
Thank you, Sam, and good luck with your work.